Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, August 8th. Maui is in our thoughts today as it has been 1 year since the devastating wildfires claimed more than 100 lives and upended a community. Many people fled into the ocean to escape the wall of fire that claimed Lahaina Town. We hear from the U.S. Coast Guard about the part they played in the rescue and salvage of so many boats in the harbor. We also get an update on the effort to keep Lahaina lands in Lahaina hands. We talked with the leaders of a new land trust focused on West Maui. A teardrop sculpture lit up the night along a highway memorial last night. We'll hear about the significance from the artist who designed the piece. And in this, the season of Obon, a special tribute to Lahaina. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. One of the boaters we featured on The Conversation on Monday took part in a paddle out today as the community marks 1 year since the Lahaina wildfire disaster. And at this hour, there is a special luncheon that Maui County is hosting. And later tonight, a memorial service takes place for families who lost loved ones in the blaze. 102 victims have been identified. There are so many stories from that night and the days immediately following. Because we have been focused on harbor stories leading up to the one-year mark, we wanted to share a story that you may not have heard much about. This month, the U.S. Coast Guard marked its 234th year of providing maritime safety and security. We decided on this day to acknowledge the service of its members who took part in the rescue and recovery efforts following the wildfires. Today, Lahaina Harbor is clear of the more than 100 boats that either sank or were damaged or spared during the disaster. It was a monumental effort that included teams of contractors from companies Global Diving and Salvage, Sea Engineering, and American Marine. We talked to U.S. Coast Guard Captain Asia Kirksey last week, who walked us through the monumental task of clearing Lahaina Harbor. It was a salvage mission that was completed in December of last year.
We know how to salvage vessels that are impacted by storms, occasionally by tsunamis, but seldom ever by wildfires. And so what we found in the process of salvaging them, which we did all different, kind of using a variety of different tools from divers with lift bags, just lifting, to barges and other types of heavy lift equipment, cranes and top picks, all different kinds of ways for all the different size vessels. But what we found was that the damage to the vessels that were sunken was catastrophic. They were very damaged. Vessels that had gasoline on board had exploded and were just in pieces. Vessels that maybe hadn't exploded, but their superstructure had burned. It had burned to the waterline, but the waterline continued to rise up out of the water as the vessel became more buoyant, and then it would continue to burn down. So what we found were these keels that in some cases, you know, looked like a skeleton, you know, of the vessel, so little left of the vessel itself. It made the vessels difficult to identify, even by their owners or people who are familiar with the vessels. But it also meant that removal operations could be done by smaller, more agile and mobile types of equipment. Having divers and lift bags, you know, is a effective and efficient way to do that. But other times with some of the larger vessels that were really impacted by the heat, we thought we would have to cut those larger ones up. Some we did have to cut, but others, the metal was so brittle that the heavy lift equipment were able to sort of just bite into those and tear them into pieces just by coming at them with the cranes. It was incredible. And I wasn't always there. We had teams that were there overseeing. I had an incident-specific federal on-scene coordinator that I had assigned who was there throughout the harbor. But I visited multiple times per week and would observe the operations, especially for the larger commercial vessels that were pulled out, and to observe these large vessels that were structurally were just really destroyed and had become so brittle. It made the removal in some ways very unique, and they had to focus on safety all of the time to make sure that, you know, a vessel whose stability and structural integrity was now unknown to us, that we continued to be safe in the removal. And each vessel was handled individually. one by one, partly because it was the best way to approach it, but also because we needed to account for each individual vessel so that vessel owners would have an opportunity to know that their vessel was removed.
That must have been very hard for those boat owners, very traumatic for them.
I think that's a great point. You know, early in the response, as we were trying to determine how best to get information out, the media aspect of the response got complicated early on. What we determined was that the best way to ensure that the vessel owners had the information they needed early on was to contact them directly. We actually ended up establishing a harbor coordination group where we considered our primary customer throughout this entire event. There's the state, you know, we were working on behalf of the state, but really we were all working on behalf of the owners and operators of the vessels in the harbor. And so it was so important to us to make sure that they had a place that they could ask all of their questions, that we, as we were able to show them pictures, you know, the area was unsafe and restricted, but we were able to show them pictures of what we were seeing on a day-to-day basis and answer their questions. And their concerns were varied, but in some cases it was just the emotional toll and they wanted an opportunity to
say goodbye,
cases,
I imagine.
Say goodbye.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we did provide that opportunity to them once we understood that that was a priority, including, you know, before we started removal operations, even gathering to do a pule with owners and others who were interested. And other times, you know, making sure they had the opportunity at the site where we put all the vessels, where they were transitioned to the Army Corps of Engineers. But being responsive to their emotional needs was as big a priority for us.
That was Captain Asia Kirksey talking about the salvage efforts to clear Lahaina Harbor of the 100 burned and wrecked vessels that were on the ocean floor. We should mention that just 2 weeks ago, the Coast Guard Foundation held a special ceremony to acknowledge the efforts of its personnel who took part in the emergency response in that first day or so of the disaster. Coast Guard's men and women aren't trained for fires, but sprung into action and did what they could to rescue those who fled to the ocean to escape the flames. The Coast Guard recently released a video clip on its Facebook page in a nod to what their team did and what they went through that night. We thought we would play it for you because you should hear directly from them.
Sector Honolulu, I'm going to help you.
We're surrounded by fire on both ends. We can't get out.
How many people are with you?
There's got to be at least 50 people. At least, I would say at least.
People that we need on the 45.
People are scared. People are really scared.
I'm going to get BM1 on the line.
The night of the fire, I was the acting officer in charge. The Second Command Center requested that they make an attempt to go into Lahaina Harbor. I remember that being just an incredibly eerie radio transmission to hear.
Hey, just let them know we got three birds in the air. We got our Coast Guard one, and we got two Navy helicopters in Lahaina.
I don't think we had any concept of how bad it was until we got there.
Extreme turbulence.
Extreme turbulence.
Extending 2 miles offshore.
Extending two miles offshore. That's from our helo crew.
I think we're going to save the day, but we couldn't even come below 500 feet without concern of descending into the water.
As we entered the harbor, it was hard to see through the smoke. The smoke would burn your eyes.
It was just so hot. You could feel the heat from the fires.
We could hear explosions and we could hear the folks on the break wall yelling to us.
So they proceeded inbound, and they would have small gaps in smoke where they would be able to see people on the jetty and see other people in distress.
Once we actually saw, you know, people in distress, like turning around wasn't an option anymore.
Our Maui team's on scene. What's on scene, they're trying to get to these people. The people would have to transit at least 200 yards from our boat because of the reef.
In this scenario, the playbook was thrown out. So we had to make some decisions that were slightly outside of policy. And we had to do that in order to be productive and effective and do the right thing for the community.
I can see you guys.
We can't get our boat close enough to you guys. So more than likely, you guys are going to have to enter the water with the Coast Guard rescue swimmer, okay?
Everybody start heading that way.
Yes.
Coast Guard's picking us up. Hey, everybody, turn your lights on. The Coast Guard's looking for us. We're coming in.
Coast
I've never been more proud of a group of men and women that I've ever worked with or ever been a part of in my entire life. And just the admiration I have for them, the heroism that they displayed, just full of pride for what this unit and the members of those boat crews did.
And U.S. Coast Guard Commander Kirsten Hahn joined our conversation with Captain Kirksey. She shared with us that the ordeal was traumatic for their personnel, some of whom had very recently joined the service. That night, one of the rescue swimmers worked with a lifeguard and used paddle boards to help bring people in the water to safety. Here's Hahn.
It was certainly unprecedented, and the Coast Guard does not train to respond to fires or rescue people from fires. So there was a lot of initiative and drive and bravery exercised by really the 8 people who went out in 2 boats to save people that first night on August 8th. And what they went through included, you know, not just no visibility with intense smoke and intense heat, but flying embers. You know, the only thing they could see was flame. And the wind was blowing so hard they couldn't hear anything. So they were navigating, hoping to find somebody through the smoke. So that night, you know, 2 boat crews from Station Maui rescued 17 people and assisted approximately 40 with their partners from the Department of Land and Natural Resources and the local fire department, as well as the police department. What they experienced was harrowing. They're very young people. You know, some of them recently had been enlisted in the Coast Guard, so hadn't even reached their 21st birthday. So it's been a slow recovery. I've worked with them regularly, and I think, you know, they're a bit fatigued. They want to move on, and they want to maintain their ties with the community. They actively engage with the community, and we look forward to honoring what happened.
You know, we heard stories about your people going out on paddle boards and bringing people in because your vessel, you know, obviously couldn't get through over the reef there, but you knew there were people that needed help.
Right. Yeah, that story was after about 11 p.m. at night. We sent the second boat crew towards Front Street by Fleetwood Restaurant, and we knew there were a lot of people on the shore trapped. So they made a plan, and it took 2 attempts to send a Coast Guard surface swimmer on a paddleboard to the shore to try to shuttle people back to the boat. We had charter vessels that had volunteered to get underway and help us with the rescue. And on the second attempt, an off-duty lifeguard from one of the charter vessels volunteered to help, and he also paddled in with us to the surfboard. They eventually recovered 2 people, and they were children, from the shoreline, paddled them back to the boat. And when they went for the second rescue, the police department had showed up and had a vehicle ready to recover people. Those 2 individuals ended up helping the 40 people to the vehicle and carrying some of them as well, who were not able to walk on their own. As I said, it was a rough day, and I was proud just this past Saturday to have recognized the 8 Coast Guard men and women who responded with Coast Guard medals, which were given by our commandant, Admiral Fagan, which is our highest honor for bravery and search and rescue that we have in the Coast Guard.
Well, we know that you folks put yourselves out on the line to rescue mariners, you know, out on the high seas, everything from, you know, high angle rescues. It's just amazing. You know, we've seen the lengths at which you go to rescue people. So this event that night, I know was a tough one for everybody. And, you know, we're all part of the same community, and it was nice to hear stories over this past year of how some of those first responders were able to meet with their with the people that they helped rescue that night. And, you know, it was just reassuring that people were trying to move into this recovery phase.
Right, I agree.
Anything else you want to add just about what you saw, you know, in the months that followed and how your people responded?
You know, I'll say it's been interesting to observe people's reactions. We have people who are part of Sector Honolulu who are from Hawaii, who are from Maui, others who've just lived here for a long time, but each individual has their own kind of unique response to something traumatic like this, and it is a combination of their background, their connection, their involvement, but also like their, you know, just their own processing of it. And so we've tried to ensure that as different people have their reactions, whether they're weeks, months, or maybe even years after their role in the response, that we're ready to offer them support and give them what they need to help them kind of continue to move through this and to come out on the other side, you know, stronger and proud of the work that they did. But the reactions have varied, you know, really to as many people as we've had be a part of it. But collectively, our team has been so proud of the work that they've done. I'm so proud of them. And I know that the leadership of the Coast Guard is so incredibly just grateful for them. But also, we were not alone out there. And the community was such a huge part of it, too. So we're also just so grateful for the community. And we stand with them as they continue in their recovery. And they're just so resilient and so incredible. So we're really proud to be a part of this whole Ohana here in the state.
That was Captain Asia Kirksley and Commander Kirsten Hahn, who we talked to earlier this month about the rescue and the recovery efforts that they took part in a year ago off Lahaina Harbor. We will have pictures of the 8 Coast Guard members who were honored recently for their efforts that night and in the days that followed. We'll have them on our conversation page of our website after the show.
Thirty years ago, James Davison Hunter coined the term culture wars. Since then, those wars have poisoned American politics. But in his new work, Hunter says the only thing that can end a culture war are cultural resources that create a sense of national solidarity. And he says those cultural resources are gone from American life. But what exactly are they? And can they be renewed? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Elections, reminding Hawaii residents that completed ballots must be received by 7 p.m. Saturday, August 10th. Ballot drop box and voter service center locations at elections.hawaii.gov.
In the aftermath of the Lahaina wildfire, a large looming question was, what's going to happen to the land? Rumors started to swirl that the government was going to take possession. Many also feared that outside investors would start to prey on desperate victims. It was out of those concerns that the Lahaina Community Land Trust was formed last November. Its mission? To keep Lahaina lands in Lahaina hands. Autumn Ness is the executive director. She was living in Japan during the 2011 tsunami disaster and witnessed how large corporate investors buying up land in the aftermath impacted the surrounding communities and the environment. The conversations, Russell Subiano sat down with Ness and the Trust's board president, Mikey Burke.
Right up front on your website, it says, keeping Lahaina lands in Lahaina hands. Can you share what that means and how the trust can accomplish that?
At our first homeowners meeting, we asked 150 people in the room what keep Lahaina lands in Lahaina hands means to them. And they wrote post-it notes on a piece of paper, all of their answers. And nobody was like looking at each other, but they all had a theme. It was like generational families, our kids need to be able to afford to stay, culture, a town and an infrastructure that puts the actual residents first before tourism, an economy that works for them, and just a place where they feel like they're not second fiddle, like they're not the cog in this engine for somebody else. You know, that's what Lahaina homeowners were saying. So there's like tools and frameworks and programs to make that happen, but I just really want to make sure that that's highlighted. I've worked on affordable housing policy and anti-displacement and fair housing in Maui for over a decade. And I've been told as someone who works in that world that it's impossible because of the American Constitution and fair housing laws for us to really actively put Lahaina folks or Maui folks in general first when it comes to housing. 10 years, people told me it's impossible. And we're learning now that that's not the case, that this term anti-displacement, I only just started using it because it's a thing. Populations at risk of displacement are a federally protected class of people. And there are big towns that have been dealing with the rising cost of living and displacement of people. Seattle, San Francisco have active anti-displacement housing policies. And so, yeah, we're taking a page from their book. I can explain what that means a little bit after Mikey chimes in on this. So we can make policies in land ownership and in housing that actually give weight to longtime Lahaina residents.
For me, keep Lahaina lands in Lahaina hands. I don't know how to give you an elevator pitch for this. Lahaina is the village that raised me, and I want to do everything that I can to make sure that it's the right village raising our children and our grandchildren. And what that looks like to me is, at the end of the day, the people who are trying to protect this place, you know who they are because they're the ones that show up to every single meeting when the kahea goes out. Whether it's protecting Vai, it's protecting Kai, Aina, it's all the same people that come out. It's all the same people who write in testimonies to county council whenever something seems to be amiss and it's going to affect people of Maui, specifically people in Lahaina, absolutely. And it's those families that we're the ones that are going to bear the burden, right? Anybody who comes here and plays on our shores and decides to take a sabbatical here and then can go ahead and move back to their own hometown, that's a very different pilina to have to a place. Those are not the people who are fighting every single day to make sure that our children have safe access to all the things that they need. Those are the families that I envision when I hear keep Lahaina lands in Lahaina hands. It's the people who know their kuleana to this place. And it's not by ethnicity. Lahaina is a beautiful mix of cultures because of the plantations that we've had here. But it's the people who have kuleana to this place that are standing up and fighting to protect the place. Those are the hands that we want to keep it for. And you can see that in our advisory board. We've put together, I think, a really good group of Lahaina leaders to help us to form the future of the land trust. And while we weren't going after like, okay, we need Filipino representation, we need Tongan representation, we need Haole representation, it was who are the people in our community that we trust to understand that what we're doing now is to help 9 generations to come. And so we have an eclectic mix of people. Just so happens, they're the right ethnicities to also go back into their own cultures and their own circles to spread the message in the way that they know that their own people will understand it.
I know it's early on, and I think in a lot of people's minds, a land trust has a lot to do with conservation. If you were to acquire land, is it just meant for conservation, or are there other ways that the land can either house people or be of service to the public?
There's all kinds of land trusts. Currently, a lot of what exists in Hawaii is conservation land trusts, but across the continent, there are also housing land trusts. And the common denominator with land trusts are that they remove the capitalistic drive to extract every penny or every dollar value out of a piece of land. That's why people put land in conservation. This is not a wealth generator. This is for conservation, right? It's the same thing with housing. So when a housing land trust or community land trust purchases land that's going to go into its housing program, the land below it is taken out of the investor-driven or the speculative housing market and becomes not a commodity anymore. The house on top becomes a home, a stable home for somebody that allows them to generate like modest equity, but the land below is protected. And so that's the thing that it shares, community land trusts and conservation land trusts. When we talk to the community about starting a land trust post-fire, we heard really loud and clear that Yes, housing is obviously front and center because that's how people are going to be able to stay or not in their home. But we also heard that, like Mikey was saying, people weren't really stoked about what Front Street, what the commercial center of Lahaina looked like pre-fire. And so people said, if you're going to create an entity that focuses on securing lands when they go up for sale out of speculator hands, can we make it a hybrid so that lands that are bought up, we can buy them up and then give the community some time. Oh, this obviously is suitable for housing. And so we're going to put housing on top of that. This used to be an ABC store, but maybe it shouldn't be anymore. Maybe it should be a locally owned, regenerative, economic driver space. Maybe this piece of land was developed before, but never should have because it's really culturally or ecologically important. So let's put that in conservation. So from the gates, Lahaina Community Land Trust was developed to kind of be a hybrid and to be able to, as land goes up for sale, secure it and give the community time to figure out, when I say highest and best use of that land in the capitalistic form, that's like how much money it can make. But in the community land trust form, that's what value does it have for the next, you know, 7, 9, 10 generations.
The more we connect with people across the continent about land trusts, the more empowered we are to believe that what we're doing in Lahaina isn't just important for Lahaina, it's to give hope for the rest of the Paiaina that this can be done in your own communities. So, I mean, that's a lot of kuleana to have on our shoulders too.
Yeah. And the thing is,
to the Paiaina, but I think it's going to give everybody hope that we can turn the tide everywhere.
And the thing is, so many people have said this so much more eloquently than I'm going to right now, but if we think about outside of the land trust model, you know, one landowner or a potential land purchaser versus some entity that owns all this land, you can't compete with that. Individually, a single homeowner, a single family, even a single small hui, it's hard to compete against these giant wealth-driven forces that, around land. But together, communally, community-funded, community-owned, we can compete in that market. So in Lahaina, we hope to do that. And we hope that across Hawaii, people think about this too.
It's not about just making sure that homes are affordable for the community, but it's a lifestyle change. So imagine you could have a mortgage for either $1 million or $500,000, right? When you take out the land, it's your mortgage for the house is $500,000. That could be the difference between you being a 2 or 3 income household to being a 1 or 2 income household. And that gives you time back, time for your all the things you want to do, time to be at your keiki's practices and all the events. The vaivai is in the lifestyle that you can have when you're not having to spend all your time working to pay for this astronomical mortgage just to stay in your home and raise your children in the place that they deserve to be raised in.
Autumn and Mikey, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate talking to you.
Thank you, Russell. We appreciate you.
That was Lahaina Community Land Trust Executive Director Autumn Ness and Board President Mikey Burke talking to HPR's Russell Subiono. Ness says they're still in the capacity building stage, but currently have more than $3 million in funding to acquire residential and open space parcels, and they hope for more funding. She expects the implementation to begin during year 2. We'll have a link to more information about the trust on our website after the show.
We are strong and we are steadfast as we follow the river home. Through the ones who've risen, through the waters set in stone, rising from the ashes.
Aloha, this is Steve Kerwood, host of Living on Earth. I'm excited to be on Hawaii Public Radio for a weekly look at climate, ecological health, and environmental justice. We confront the challenges of climate disruption, but also showcase the spectacular biodiversity of the planet we call home, including species like Hawaii's very own Nene. Join me tonight at 7 here on HBR One.
Aloha, I'm Anita Rao, host of Embodied, a new program on Hawaii Public Radio.
sex and relationships can be intimidating to talk about. So I am here to lead the way. Join me as we explore our brains and our bodies, a journey that touches down in taboo territory. Embodied is Sundays at 10 a.m. on HPR One.
If you've driven along the highway into Lahaina over the past year, you may have seen the row of white crosses erected in honor of the 102 fire victims that have been identified. Soukai Taufau is one of the many community volunteers who helped create the memorial. Today, something new has been added to the site. HVR Sophia McCullough talked to Taufau about the teardrop structure that was unveiled and was lit up last night.
Yeah, I'm responsible for all this memorial thing going on over here. A week after the fire, I went to my friend's house and I overheard these two ladies, they are organizing some kind of memorial. And they are arranging some people to make flowers and make ribbon. And they wanted to make some crosses, but they don't know who's going to make it. But I'm over here listening to them. I can make all those. I have all the tools and the materials at my house. And I came home, pull out all my tools and my materials, but I, in the back of my head, I still remember it's Sunday and I just finished church. And I'm gonna break the Sabbath rules. And I was thinking about those and I said, well, if I do this to help out my fellow communities here, and I guess it's okay. And we weren't doing this, it was on Sunday. And that's when the president is going to visit here in Maui on Monday. And we were rushing to make all the crosses. So we were thinking the president is going to drive down here. And he's probably going to have a chance to look at all the crosses. By then, the number was sky high. We're in the thousands, according to all the news and all the stories going around here. Because nobody really knows what's going on. People are missing. So we were trying to make as many as we can get. By 3:30 in the morning, we make like 73 crosses. So I tell Matt that we're gonna take a little break here and we're gonna bring the crosses to his wife, Shanine and Sonia, so they can come and start hanging those crosses and we're gonna stay back on Monday and make the rest. So we stay back on Monday and make a total 137, I think. And about 2 to 3 weeks, I come back here. Nobody here. The weeds started growing. And I was saying to myself, maybe I'll just come and watch the whole place. And I just come and start cleaning, weed eating, cleaning up the mess. And start hearing story about people. There was a couple old people, they died together. So I was coming up, I tried to put them together so I come up making those double heart and the double crosses for those people. Or whoever their boyfriend, girlfriend, so about a few weeks later, I heard about a lot of people, they lost their pet. So I start, you know, try to figure it out how I'm gonna make a memorial for them. So I start collecting, I call around, but then I don't have all the material, so I call around all my friends, also those people that I used to work for them before, to see if they can donate some materials for what I'm making. And I supposed, you know, start cutting those figure for cat. And I come and hang it and I put them up in the media and people start requesting you have birds. So I make birds and people, they say, well, we have cats, guinea pigs. So I keep making it, whatever they request me for make it, you know, hang them up here.
Are you also responsible for organizing all of the photos?
No, those his name is Jason. He used to have a printing shop here. And he's one of them, he's lost his houses and the business survived. All those the business around him, they all burned down. So when he come down over here, there was nothing going on here in the town. So and he saw what's going on over here, then he decided to donate those pictures. And some people, they donate those solar lights. So that's one thing. Sometimes I come down here and wait here till night, till dark, so I can rearrange all the lights to make sure everybody have their own lights. And, you know, over the month, we see new pictures. Every month here, maybe every 2 weeks, I have to stay back till dark and see who else is here so they can share all the lights.
Do you come every day?
Pretty much. But all those times, I was thinking about what we're going to help the community in the healing process about the upcoming 1 year anniversary. So I come up with the teardrop, and then I try to design it, and I take it with me everywhere, I sleep with it to see how I'm going to make it. And it's right here. It's ready to go.
So why a teardrop?
It's kind of represent the real tragedy here, what's going on here. And I was thinking about something that can help the people they have loved ones they lost here with their healing process. Maybe give them some kind of hope. Kind of get emotional talking about that. But this one here is made out of rebar. But we were working on to see with these people who own this land here to see if they can lease or donate this piece of land. They want to move this thing here down to somewhere in Lahaina by Camp 3, I heard. But I'm working over here on the side, and I met a lot of people. They have a loved one here, and this is the spot they want. This is how when they go somewhere, if they go out Lahaina and they're coming in, they have a little chance to say hi, see the little spiritual talking to them. And they have a chance to look at them every day when they drive around here in the town.
Yeah, so if you had it your way, what would a monument look like?
This,
but bigger.
No, actually, when I'm finished here, that's the actual size
okay.
It's going to be. It will be 16 feet high by 10 feet wide. But it's a teardrop shape size. And it's going to be a hole in the middle that will represent the missing tears. And you're going to have a channel through inside the teardrop right in the middle, in the center of it. And we'll go run right through and on the very top. And I'm going to try to put some kind of clear glass cap or a crown or whatever you can call it. So, and we put a spotlight on the bottom. The idea is that whatever soul is remaining here with us, the light will carry those through the channels and just go beyond that, straight up to heaven. The only group that helping me is the Lottery Club, and I'm a member of the Lahaina Sunset Lottery Club. They are the one who keep me going so far.
Yeah, where do you live, by the way?
I live up in Lanipoko area, but here, it's all me. I've been taking care of this, so it's almost a year now, but before, we pretty much need to redo it twice a week. Yeah, but now it's summer time now, then the grass is kind of died down.
Do a lot of visitors?
Huh?
Do a lot of visitors?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of, quite a few.
Tourists mostly,
yeah.
Or friends of family?
Everybody. And, you know, all the local tourists, they just come in and out every day. I'm very happy they have a place to come and show their respect. And they are very happy too. It's right, it's easy access for them.
So the wood, so this is just going to be the frame, right? And it's going to be inside.
All this one here, we're going to put them up, and when all the rebar and the shape is going up, all the wood will be disappear. And just the teardrop shape is going to stand. And all those posts here, they have paint. It's going to stay. That's where we're going to hang the light around it and some flags on top.
And it's your own idea.
Yeah. I collect materials, buy materials with my own money. So far, I have some people, they donate a little bit here and there, but it's helped. But I borrow a lot of materials from my friends. And whatever I can have in my pocket, I kind of racked up my credit card on this project here. But it's okay. But after all this done, then I'm going to go back to work.
It seems like it means a lot to you.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot more than that. It's for the whole community.
That was Sokai Taufa talking with HPR Sophia McCullough about a new art piece along the Lahaina Bypass commemorating the victims of last August wildfires. Taufa says those interested in helping out with his efforts can donate to the Lahaina Sunset Rotary Club. We'll have a link to more information on our website later today.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
Aloha, this is Bert Lum, host of Bite Marks Cafe. The show has moved to a new day and time, Fridays at 6:30 p.m. on HPR One. Join us as we showcase the creativity and innovation in Hawaii's tech community. Download past episodes of Bite Marks Cafe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the free HPR app. Bite Marks Cafe, now on Fridays at 6:30 p.m. on HPR One.
This weekend, the Maui community is invited to take part in an Ubon dance, as this is the season for the cultural event. But it will take on new meaning this Sunday, as dancers will perform moves choreographed to a new song written about life in Lahaina. We talked to Maui resident Lance Collins, who co-wrote that song and takes part in a music video put together by dancers across the state, which drops today. You know, and this effort really took a village of Ubon lovers. Take a listen. Collins says the Lahaina Hongguanji burned down in last year's fire before the community could hold its ceremony to honor those who came before us. It is now inviting the public to come together on Sunday to take part in this Ubon dance, this cultural tradition.
So, you know, I've been doing Ubon dancing since I was a kid. And, you know, there's like a lot of really good songs. And it's sort of like, you know, songs have particular periods and almost all of the songs come from Japan. There are a few Hawaii songs. And it was just something before COVID, actually, that I had been talking with other people about, like, oh, you know, we don't really have a lot of Hawaii songs and dances. And so eventually, Mrs. Tatsuguchi and I, and she's the Bomori at the Shinsho Kyokai Mission in Honolulu, we started working on what was just going to be a song about basically like a young person's summertime in Lahaina. And when we've been working on it for 3 years, and then when the fire happened, you know, we had a discussion and we agreed that we need to finish it so that we could contribute to supporting the Lahaina community in a slightly different way than some of the other activities and supports that folks in the community have done.
So then this story is about memories of Lahaina.
Yeah, they're just snippets of basically everyday life in the summer in Lahaina. So it talks about surfing, it talks about mango picking, it talks about fishing, talks about hiking, talks about doing stuff in the stream, and of course, importantly, doing a bon dance.
Yes, and you are marking this anniversary with the dance this weekend. And so what do people need to know?
The most important thing is hopefully folks in Maui will come to the dance on August 10th. But, you know, the whole purpose of Ubon is to honor our ancestors and the people that came before us. And so, you know, the August 10th dance and the song, hopefully, you know, is a way to honor the memories of those, you know, who passed on. And even those folks who actually passed before the fire but didn't get to have their Hatsu Bon because the Lahaina Hongguanji mission burned down before their dance last year. So I mean, that's the hope, is that, you know, this is a time where we can honor all of that and we can do it in a joyful way and celebrate, you know, the memories and the happy memories of our ancestors and the people that came before us, and also of our own memories that are in the past.
you know, what do people need to know about, you know, where this is all happening, you know, what
Yeah, so it's going to be on August 10th at the Lahaina Cannery, and the county is providing parking across the street at the Lahaina Gateway off of Chiave Street, and there will be shuttles going back and forth, and the dance is scheduled to go from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., so of course, try to come before 5 because that's when the dance itself starts. And, you know, it's just like any other bon dance. So, you know, please be respectful and, you know, honor the purpose of the event. And most importantly, you know, have fun and have a good time in celebrating our ancestors in the past.
Well, talk about how you composed it and, you know, who is performing the music and the dances.
So the writing of the song took a bit of time. And it was primarily based on my observations, experiences, and in discussion with other people. And then Mrs. Tatsuguchi and I, this is what took the longest time, is because what I wrote in English is not something that you can just put into Google Translate and then have a bondan song, because, you know, poetic Japanese or song Japanese is, you know, like it's a little bit complicated, at least for my mind, because I'm not a fluent Japanese speaker. And so that's what took a long time, because all of the imagery had to be adjusted to fit into Japanese. And so that's what took really the long time in doing that. And then when that was done, then Paolo Cotrone, who's a notori in traditional Japanese music, and Joel Katz, who's a instructor at Maui College, a music instructor at Maui College, they put the instruments together for the song. And then Colette Gomoto and Brian Nagami provided the vocals. And Marion Kanemori of Iwakuni Odori Aikokai, a bon dance club, she choreographed the dance. And so that all sort of came together. And then earlier, a couple weeks ago in July, Kaylee Grace, who's an award-winning movie director, he shot a music video with all of the leading bon dance clubs on Oahu at the Shincho Kyokai Mission, which is the temple that Mrs. Tatsuguchi is the bomori of. Yeah, so it all sort of happened relatively quickly once we got the lyrics down. And we have the song and a music video that's going to also come out on August 8th. And then the dance will be performed by the community and presented to the public for the first time on the 10th at the Bondance.
I mean, that's really terrific, you know, just to hear how you have been able to reach out across the state to get people involved, just to evoke, you know, the emotions about life in Lahaina before the wildfires.
Yeah, and, you know, this is the wonderful thing, that basically we had like 100 dancers mm-hmm. participated in the music video, and everybody, you know, contributed their time to this. And, you know, in one sense, it's remembering Lahaina. And then in another sense, it really is, you know, it's remembering, I think, everybody's childhood in Hawaii that did all of these different, I mean, that's one of the things about Lahaina, was that it's very unique, and at the same time, there's a universal appeal to the, you know, happy memories that people have of their childhood in Hawaii.
Well, you know, we often think of our favorite song about Lahaina, because there's so many wonderful songs, Hawaiian songs and contemporary songs, and then we can add this bon dance song to the list as well.
Yes.
And gosh, so are we going to see you out there dancing?
Absolutely. I will be out there dancing. No question about it. And I hope to see not only all the familiar faces in the bon dance circle, but I really hope to see, you know, a lot of people that might not normally come out, you know, come out and enjoy the food and, you know, enjoy the fellowship and, you know, have fun, dance or watch or do both.
And so what is it about bon dance that grabbed you as a kid?
So, yeah, it's actually a kind of a complicated story, but the short of it is that I had a neighbor named Toyama-san, who's actually mentioned in the song. He was a retired Okinawan baker, and he usually went to bed, like, right after dinner. But he took me to, we lived in Wailuku at the time, and he took me to a couple of bon dances, and I really liked the idea of, like, a bunch of people in the community just getting together and sort of dancing, and there's no respect, there's like no qualifications to get into the ring. And, you know, as long as you do it in good faith, you know, even if you make mistakes, it's okay. And I liked that, and I kept doing it, and I enjoyed the fellowship of the people who go to bon dances and bon dancers. And, you know, I've made a lot of friends over the years from it. And, you know, I'm not Japanese, I'm Filipino and white, but it's become more of a, seemingly more of a Japanese thing than it was when I was a kid. It seemed to be a little more multi-ethnic when I was younger, but it still has that sort of harkens back to the working class of the plantation era about communal spirit and that sort of thing. And I was very drawn to it as a kid. And I, have stuck with it over the years because I enjoy it. And so that's how I came to be involved in bon dancing. And I am a member of Iwakuni Odori Aikokai, which is one of the bon dance clubs in Hawaii. And and I dance in Honolulu dances and I dance in Maui dances. It's harder to dance at the Honolulu ones because the last flight to Maui is very early now. So if I dance in Honolulu, I can only do it if I'm already spending the night or if I spend the night in Honolulu. But I enjoy it. And, over the years, I've gone to temples in, Hawaii and in Hawaii Island. And also, of course, every year, this is something that maybe people don't know, but for the last maybe 30 years or more, it's actually been primarily Lahaina dancers that have provided the dancers for the Lanai'i Hongwanji Bon Dance. And I used to go over every year with that group to provide dancers for their dance. And that tradition continues despite the fire. But yes, I've been to, I've basically been to bon dances on every island, including Molokai. And it's just, it's a wonderful thing for the community to come together and sort of, honor everybody's ancestors and the people that came before us and have a good time in the present and, do it through a little bit of physical activity.
Yeah, just a little bit of physical activity there. That was Maui's Lance Collins sharing the story of the new bon dance that will be performed for the first time this weekend to honor those who have gone before us. Mahalo to him and the many hearts who helped to create this new dance for Lahaina and for all of us. And that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we get an update on the state of the recovery process for fire survivors. Got a Lahaina story to share? Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Apple, Spotify, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.